funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the internet do for you? Have you thought about what it does to you and to the society we live in? Heralded as one of the most important technological developments in modern history, the internet provides quick, cheap, and convenient access to information and allows nonstop communication with people all over the world. But does all that information translate to real knowledge? And does our ability to express ourselves in millions of places foster genuine communication? Lee Siegel is not convinced. He is a senior editor at The New Republic, and he lays out his concerns in a new book called Against the Machine, How the Web is Reshaping Culture and Commerce and Why It Matters. Lee, welcome to Think.
My pleasure to be here.
You write that things don't have to be the way they are. What's wrong with the internet the way it is right now?
Well, it's really become a huge commercial juggernaut, and there's just so much junk on it. In fact, today in the New York Times, Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, was quoted by Maureen Dowd as saying that most of what's on the internet is, quote, a sewer, unquote. It's indiscriminate. It allows people to vent. It allows them to vent anonymously. It embraces slander, libel, many of our worst impulses. You know, the blessings of the internet are many and are touted far and wide, but no one wants to talk about how this thing has just opened up a door to forces that we just can't control.
Why do you think more people don't look at the internet's rise with trepidation? Are we afraid of looking as if we stand in the way of progress?
I think that's certainly a big part of it. The worst thing you can be called in America is a dinosaur or someone who's out of it. Certainly newspapers, which are being destroyed by the internet, are terrified of criticizing it, which is tragic, because newspapers are really vital to a democracy, and they have no business model for this thing. They've assimilated it entirely, but it's destroying them. And it would not be the worst thing in the world for newspapers to run a series critical of many aspects of the internet. I know the New York Times began a series, a very interesting series, which was meant to examine the way the internet is affecting people's reading skills and communication skills. They ran one installment of that, and it was discontinued. So there's this terrible fear that the internet will somehow strike back, will take its revenge on people who don't admire it publicly.
And we should say you're not a person who never gets online. It's a tool that you use in your work on a regular basis.
Well, in fact, I must correct you. I'm no longer a senior editor of the New Republic. I left the magazine, and I do write freelance for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. But I also have a more or less of a weekly column at the Daily Beast, which is a wonderful online magazine, and is very much in the vanguard of the internet. And so, yes, indeed, I use the internet. I depend on the internet for part of my livelihood, and I enjoy the internet. But I do think that it's very important to be critical of this new technology, which has just come over us all of a sudden in 15 years, and which, again, to repeat, no one is able to control.
You make this really interesting analogy between the internet and the invention of the automobile. Can you talk about some of the similarities you see?
Yeah, like the internet, the automobile was a miraculous technology when it began. And no one criticized the automobile. The automobile was immediately associated with mobility, with optimism, with American power. And to criticize the internet made you seem not only behind the times, but also unpatriotic in some way. It certainly made you seem irrelevant. But the automobile was killing 50,000 people a year because no one had thought to try to invent and install safety measures. And this went on for quite some time until Ralph Nader wrote his book Unsafe at Any Speed, which forced the big three automakers, who have their own troubles today, to implement rather costly safety measures, but which saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of people by now. And the internet has the same this is in the same situation. It is associated with modernity, with progress, with optimism, with American business and the American spirit, and to criticize it makes you seem unpatriotic and behind the times. And it is not killing people, of course, but it is having very deleterious effects. You know, Facebook is invading people's privacy. It's turning friends into objects, commodifying human relationships. The advent of the internet in the financial world was to a great extent responsible for the financial crisis. It is impossible to control the lightning speed transactions that were made over the past 10, 15 years in electronic form. And that's part of the reason we are where we are today in the economy. But the lack of criticism of the internet, like lack of criticism of the automobile, is just having a terrible effect on the social fabric.
So at 15 years or so of really all-pervasive presence in American culture, we could argue that this is a technology that's in its adolescence. In the grand scheme of things, it may still be in its infancy. Why do you think that we can't just assume that these problems will sort themselves out as we all mature in our approach to using this technology?
Well, they will sort themselves out, but they will sort themselves out a lot faster if we acquire a critical detachment towards the internet. They will sort themselves out much more slowly if we're afraid to criticize it at all.
We do a lot of our communicating online via printed text, but you do not see this as the equivalent to writing. Can you talk about that?
Well, I know that when I'm composing an email, I know that when I used to blog, I had a cultural blog at the New Republic. You think instantaneously. There's no room for reflection. It's somewhere between writing and talking. And without reflection, without a kind of patience, without a detachment from what you are saying, you're really not writing. You're doing something else. I don't know what to call it. I don't think calling it blogging or emailing is enough. There should be some other term for what you do when you're online. Certainly, text messaging and instant messaging people is some new mode of communication somewhere between talking and writing, but it's certainly not writing.
Mm-hmm. When you had your blog, and a lot of people have probably heard this story, you were criticized and then sort of succumbed to the temptation that I think a lot of people feel to do the same thing and anonymously write back to your critics.
Yeah, well, I did what many journalists were doing and who wouldn't admit to doing it. This was at the beginning of the blogosphere. The New Republic was allowing people to say whatever they wanted to say. Many of these comments were libelous. That doesn't happen now, partly because of my incident. I answered these people. I really got fed up when someone called me a pedophile. As a result of my little scandal and the book that I wrote afterwards, magazines and newspapers are much more careful about what they allow people to post, especially anonymously. So there was certainly a silver lining to that brief cloud.
Why do you think from the very beginning websites have allowed people to comment on things without having to give their real information?
You mean their true identity?
Right, exactly.
Well, I think magazines and newspapers have been terrified of this new monster since the beginning, and they're afraid that if they tell people that they want them to use their real names, that people will stop subscribing. But I think that now that those fears have subsided, and although people are allowed to use aliases, they are certainly not allowed to say whatever they want. I know I went on a New York Times page a few months ago, and I made a comment, and it took 2 days for this comment to appear on the website. It was vetted, obviously, by one or more editors. So I don't think that the anonymous commenting is as chaotic and uncontrolled as it used to be. It's still a problem, especially in business. You know, a lot of business people have told me that they just are in despair over what their rivals are allowed to say on their websites under the cloak of anonymity. And there's a lot of poisonous stuff going on out there which people just can't control because our First Amendment laws protect a lot of what goes on the Internet.
I wonder how sophisticated you think Americans are at picking through these things that might be posted in these comments and deciding for themselves intelligently what to believe. Because I have to tell you, the kinds of comments that were written about you and that I've seen in a variety of locations about a variety of people and their work, I'm not inclined necessarily to pay any attention to the more vitriolic ones.
Yeah, I think more and more people are developing another cognitive muscle, if you will, as a result of being online, and people are becoming cannier about filtering the information that they get from the internet. But, you know, there's still a lot of vivid vitriol on there. And if you read something terrible about someone, even if you know it's not true, it lodges in your consciousness. It's there. And if you read a lot of stuff that's bad, it begins to weigh on you. You begin to falter. You begin to wonder, even if you know that it's written in a spirit of ill will. So I think, yes, there is this filtering faculty that we are developing in a kind of evolutionary sense. But I think that rumor is rumor. A rumor can be very powerful. A rumor can take root and pass itself off as truth. And the internet amplifies the ability of rumor to do so.
I wonder if you can talk about who holds the power on the internet and who grants that power.
Well, certainly Google. Google is this, again, to use the word, a monster, which is vexing everyone. And everyone wants, you know, to be linked to and on Google, and everyone wants those golden Google ads. Big corporations like Google certainly have all the power. Google, Microsoft, and any other corporation that buys these websites, any corporation that owns Facebook. Facebook is not owned by anyone, but certainly MySpace has been bought by News Corp and other social networking sites. So I would say that the corporations have the same power that they used to have in the old model, when you only had three networks and a bunch of newspapers and movie studios. Now, supposedly, the internet shattered that hierarchy, and now you have power from below, but the power from below is really not as powerful as the corporations that own most of the internet.
So you definitely argue with this concept that so many people have, that the internet is a fully democratic entity.
I think in some ways it's more democratic. You could go on to YouTube and you can play the violin beautifully, or you can have a comedy act or something like that. Maybe you'll get known. There are not many cases of that, however. And I really think that the internet's just creating a newer hierarchy with maybe more closed doors than there were before. There are more doors, but they're also closed.
Well, I guess there's also the question of how many doors one can open in a typical day or week or year of looking at things.
That's right, and I think that, you know, that brings us to the to another problem of the internet, which is this absolute glut of information. People were complaining long before the internet about the TV news and radio news and news coming in from all angles. Well, look what the internet has done. Just oceans and oceans and oceans of news, and it all begins to seem relative. You know, last night I was watching cable, and there was a report on this terrible case in California of the Sunday school teacher killing her daughter's 8-year-old friend. So, okay, so then there's that. And then they have a bunch of experts talking about that. And then there's Sharon Stone talking about her own kids, you know, and everything's sort of leveled off. You have these radically different experiences, emotional experiences, and they're all portrayed in the same segment in the same way. And I think the internet, again, has magnified that. And we really can't make distinctions anymore.
Cultural critic Lee Siegel is my guest. His new book is called Against the Machine: How the Web is Reshaping Culture and Commerce and Why It Matters. We'll return to our discussion in a moment, and you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Lee Siegel is my guest. His new book is called Against the Machine, How the Web is Reshaping Culture and Commerce and Why It Matters. You're welcome to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Talk for a minute, Lee, about how we are forced to package and market ourselves online.
Well, that's a very important issue online. As I said, I believe that these social networking sites are really turning everyone into a kind of private business. If I go on my Facebook page, I actually have a very rudimentary page. I don't even have a picture of myself, and I think I only have two friends. I went on in order to write the book. But if I go onto my page, suddenly I have a billion eyes staring at me. I have to present myself in a certain way, and I'm going to craft myself according to how I want to be perceived. In this case, unlike instant messaging, I do have time to be patient and reflective. I have much more time to be patient and reflective than I would be in a face-to-face conversation with someone. I can be premeditated, I can be calculating, and what I want most of all is to be popular. I want 400 friends, I want 500 friends, I want 600 friends. If I have a blog, I want to be linked to. I want to be linked to a lot. If I'm on YouTube, I want lots and lots of views. So it's all about popularity, and popularity is all about selling yourself. And selling yourself is all about a certain degree of subterfuge. And I think the web, again, intensifies the human tendency to want to promote yourself and turns it into a kind of self-packaging.
Is it more than just an intensification of this idea that we all in public have a slightly different self than we have in our sort of backstage lives?
Well, of course, all of us present ourselves differently in public than we do in private. Even in private, we're sort of public. It's hard in the deepest sense to know exactly where we are. But when you have something, an organized way of turning yourself into a spectacle like the Internet, the instinct, as I said, the tendency that humans have to promote themselves, to package themselves, to even lie about who they are and what they do is just exaggerated 100-fold.
Lee Siegel is my guest. His book is called Against the Machine. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Ian in Dallas. Hello, Ian.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, question for your guest. I appreciated the comment earlier regarding the internet being analogous to a car, in that it you know, obviously the car caused some problems. There were some deaths, but you know, I actually have thought of a similar analogy before. But I think it's almost more accurate to say the way the car changed the landscape of our country. You know, we went from densely packed cities to suburbs. You know, people were able to go further, and it actually changed the way that the country was, I mean, shaped. And I think that the Internet's kind of done a real similar thing as far as taking information that's centrally located and is more spreading it out and making it more accessible. And but now, as Chris said earlier, this is kind of a young technology. And just as, you know, the cities are becoming more popular, people are starting to become more densely populated and urbanizing, I think that in a sense, at some point, people are going to start returning back, not necessarily to the way it was, but once the newness wears off, once everything kind of settles down, it seems kind of obvious to me that things would start to go back, not to the way they were, but to a more equilibrium. And I know you said earlier that, you know, I'm just really curious as to what your prescription is for that. You know, if you think it's not going to happen soon enough because there's no criticism or there's not enough awareness about this, what can you do to really change people's minds about that, to kind of bring it more back to a place kind of in the middle?
What do you think, Lee?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very smart point that you brought up. I do think that people will begin to rebel against the various accelerations of the internet. It's already happening. In New York, there are there's a kind of thriving scene on Broadway. You would think that people would not be paying $100 a ticket to go see Broadway plays, especially when they can, you know, when so much is available on the web and on TV, but people are, and a lot of TV stars and film stars are actually coming onto the stage where they earn a lot less money. I think people are turning to the stage because they are turning away from their screens. They're tired of their screens. And I do think that because of the kind of pendulum-like restlessness of American life, there will be a movement against the internet. Having said that, I'd like to address your question. How can we make people more aware of what's wrong with the internet? Well, certainly programs like this, where people talk and people are allowed to make criticisms without fearing that they're going to be punished. Also, the internet itself can create entities that sort of oppose the worst aspects of the internet. Again, I have to plug this wonderful online magazine that I write for, The Daily Beast, which is very much like a newspaper, an old-fashioned newspaper or magazine. It has all the pith and the speed and the up-to-dateness of the internet, but all the pieces are edited, they're long, they take some kind of patient reflection to read them, and one of the functions that this website, that this online magazine serves, is to lead people to where the important stuff is out there on the internet, and to lead them away from the irrelevant stuff. And I think you'll see more and more entities like that on the internet, which use the internet to oppose the worst energies of the internet.
Like generations of writers before you, you have spent a fair amount of time in coffee shops working and sort of hanging out. Can you talk about how that experience has changed noticeably within the last decade or so?
Oh, yeah. I remember when I was younger and starting out on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, everybody flocked to coffee shops. And there was this one great coffee shop where just for a dollar, you could get a croissant and a copy of the New York Times. Well, that disappeared a long time ago. And now you go to a coffee shop, more likely it's a chain place, a franchise like Starbucks, and you go in there, and most of the people are on their laptops, and they're emailing, and they're IMing, and they're buying stuff on eBay, they're Googling themselves, and everybody's, it's not like they're reading the newspaper. You read the newspaper in a cafe with one eye on what you're reading and one eye around you. They're totally immersed in their own pursuits, and there's a lack of human connection. There's a lack of stories unfolding, and certainly as a writer, I feel bereft when no stories are unfolding around me.
So does the fact, though, Lee, that people are still going into coffee shops as opposed to drinking their coffee at home, people are still going in there who have the $4, I guess, for a cup of coffee these days. Does that tell you that we haven't completely let go of our desire to be within a community when we're doing things?
Well, it could just be that these people have lost their homes and they have no place else to drink coffee.
Let's hope not.
Well, I think, there's always, people are the one universal trait that people have is gregariousness, and people are gregarious, and they want to go to coffee shops. They want to be with other people, but coffee shops are more and more becoming like movie theaters. You go to a movie theater to be alone, yet with other people. And there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes you really do want to be alone, but surrounded by people. But I think that people are more and more removed from each other in public settings. There are fewer and fewer public settings where you can just get up and mix with someone and approach someone or lean over and talk to someone. I think that's changing. And again, it's not all bad. Privacy is important, and a stronger space around us that separates us from other people is important. But we are losing something, I think.
Do you think that the internet created this isolation within our society, or did it just feed on something that was already there in a sort of inchoate form?
Well, I think that, take journalism, for example. I think that the internet actually represents a trend that was unfolding for a very long time. It's a good question. I think that there's a crisis in authority. Democracy has its stages, and we are at a sort of higher stage of democracy, a rising tide of democracy where older forms of authority are now in question. You see it on these shows, these celebrity reality TV shows, which drop celebrities on a desert island, and they have to survive, and they're humiliated. We no longer worship the Garbo. We no longer worship the Brando, the giant face looming on the silver screen. Now we don't like actors. We don't like the glamorous authority of the star. We want to see that deconstructed. We don't like the sort of monolithic authority of the newspaper. Democracy has reached the point where there's little tolerance for that now. Now we want to hear the voices of the readers. We want to see citizen reporters on CNN. We don't want to just hear the the talking heads. So I do indeed think that on one level the internet is the kind of consummation of a trend a long time in the making.
You sort of play with this quote from Lenin that imperialism is the final phase of capitalism, and you say the final phase of capitalism is the public unfolding of the private individual psyche. How does the internet intensify that, and why do you think it's a negative thing?
Well, I think that even before the internet, you had this tendency of people to start retailing, to start putting their private selves up for sale. You have this rash of memoirs, for example. You have a kind of crisis of the first person. There's almost no third person anymore in writing. Everything is the first person. And people can't seem to understand an experience unless first they refer it to their own experience. The internet has intensified this via blogs and so forth. People go online and they try to sell themselves. You see that on YouTube. Someone will just speak about their personal experience into the camera, hoping to get some kind of attention, maybe a book deal, a movie deal, a movie about oneself, a book about oneself. So that's capitalism's final frontier. When we've, you know, America, in a way, it's run parallel to what's happened in the economy. America, at some point, stopped really producing stuff, stopped making goods for the most part. What Americans started doing was to create financial.
Are you with us, Lee? We seem to be having some problems with the connection. We may need to call you right back. Lee Siegel is my guest. I'm going to try you one more time. Lee, are you there? All right, we're going to call him right back and get that line fixed.
Hello?
Oh, there you are. Okay,
I'm sorry, I lost you.
Okay, I'm glad you're back.
We went from abstraction in the financial realm to abstraction on the internet. And just as we stopped producing goods and started just producing abstract financial services, we stopped sort of making things with our own hands on an individual level and just started selling our own personal experience. On the one hand, I think that can be a good thing. It's very empowering to talk about yourself and have people learn about your own experience and find some universal experience in the particular. On the other hand, of course, it's very alienating to hear people just go on about themselves and not to have any sense of their shared environments with other people.
Well, what's so fascinating about that whole idea is that so many people, I think it's sort of a natural human tendency to long for that validation and to long to know that people are interested in you and what you think. So many people are out there sort of blogging and expressing themselves, as you say. And I have to wonder, at some point, are we going to run out of people who are willing to read all of this?
Well, exactly right. I don't know who's reading these blogs. You go on to some blogs and you click on the about section of the blog and you see that the blog's only had 780 views. It's been around for 5 years. I don't know who's reading the bloggers. I don't know how many bloggers even read other bloggers. You know, there's only so much tolerance we have for the experience of other people, which, after all, like our own experience, is pretty banal.
Then again, I guess if no one's reading it and people are sort of using this as a journal that exists in a digital form, there's nothing wrong with that, is there?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's really hard to quantify these things and to, you know, to judge what's right and what's wrong about them. But common sense might tell you that the more cut off we are from each other, the less we can help each other when there's a crisis. You know, I've been watching, just to go back again to what the country is going through, I've been watching, as we all have, over the past few months, the goings-on, and what strikes me is that there's no concerted movement on the part of American people. Nobody's saying, clarify, tell us what's happening. We're all so helpless. You know, one minute we're told the economy's crashing, and then the Dow is soaring, and the next minute we're told that all the investment houses are crashing, and then Goldman Sachs posts $1.9 billion profit. Who knows what's going on? And I think part of the reason is that we're all sort of cut off from each other. We're all blogging away and double clicking away and all of that, and we're not meeting in the cafes, in the streets. There hasn't been a single demonstration that I know of, a significant one, on any college campus throughout the entire last few months of the worst economic crisis since the Depression. No one protesting against layoffs in their town, no one protesting against obscure government policies, nothing like that. And I think that's frightening, and I think we've all been made passive by the illusion of individual empowerments that we get from the internet. You go on the internet, you click, you vote, you do this, you do that, but it's not changing anything, and nobody's hearing anything, and nobody's listening to anything. And the politicians themselves have now learned very well how to manipulate the internet.
Lee Siegel is my guest. The book is called Against the Machine. Let's go next to Bartonville and speak with Stuart. Hey, Stuart.
Hi. I joined this discussion a little late, so forgive me if I'm bringing up a subject that's already been covered. But I'm curious with, at least my perception, the increased polarity between different sides on any issue and the acrimony between the sides. What you feel the internet does to exacerbate that? Are the people out there trying to rally sides speaking to the choir, and there is no dialogue? People aren't talking in the coffee shops because people are afraid that they're going to encounter an opposing opinion that isn't given in a thoughtful manner.
That's exactly right. That's the echo chamber quality of the internet is a huge concern. I think because the internet makes everyone want to be popular because it enthrones popularity as the kind of highest standard of success on the internet. People, they join a chorus of voices. They throw their voice into this loud chorus of opinion because they want to be liked. They want to be popular. You know, there's no time for a kind of patient, complex approach to an issue. There's just the issue, and there are the two sides. There are no ideas. There's no leaping over the two sides. There's no thoughtfulness. You take one side or the other side because that's where all the people are, and that's where all the popularity is, and that's where all the love is. And the internet's about, you know, getting as much love for your ego as you can, often.
Lee Siegel is my guest. His new book is called Against the Machine, How the Web is Reshaping Culture and Commerce and Why It Matters. We'll be back in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Lee Siegel, whose new book is called Against the Machine, How the Web is Reshaping Culture and Commerce and Why It Matters. So, Lee, if the internet elevates popularity above all things and tends to drown out the most intelligent voices, sounds a lot like high school, actually, but if it didn't exist, are you confident that we would be seeking out those most intelligent voices from other sources?
Well, no, I'm not at all confident of that, but there would certainly be less of a clamor. There would be fewer, less intelligent voices to sift through.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I want to know if you think that there should be some sort of specific regulation. Does this need to come from within the internet industry itself? Should journalists be at the forefront of trying to decide how we change the way we communicate online?
I think certainly journalists should be at the forefront of that. There should be online magazines and paper magazines devoted to critiquing the internet. There has to be a consciousness, a critical consciousness toward the internet that has to be developed in order for people to see beyond it and in order to improve it and make it more serviceable to human ends.
Let's go next to Drew in Terrell. Hey, Drew.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was wondering if the author's just being a little bit too unfair in lumping all of social networking sites together with the vanity of Facebook. For instance, the government is moving towards social networking sites for their intelligence agencies in order for all of them to make a collaborative effort in intelligence collection and to avoid redundancy and generally other things. And you know, overwhelmingly, a lot of these officials are seeing that there are huge benefits to social networking sites. And I wanted to comment on the coffee shop issue. You know, I would love, you know, I do go to coffee shops and I do read the papers, but I read several different papers. I read some papers in Germany. I read some papers in Israel. I read some papers in Saudi Arabia. And I feel like I get a much more full understanding of what's going on rather than just being forced to read the Dallas Morning News or something along the lines of that. If you could comment on that, I'd be greatly appreciative.
Thanks for your call.
You're asking me what I think of the fact that you read many different newspapers at a cafe.
Well, and I think he was also talking about the idea that there is some value potentially to social networking sites, which was the first part of his comment.
Yes, well, as far as the social networking of intelligence agencies, that sounds good to me until someone who's an enemy of the state joins the social networking site. I don't know how they keep those kinds of things secure, but certainly that's a special case, what the intelligence agencies are doing. I think in the more ordinary course of our lives, sites like Facebook, and Facebook really is the most popular site, just tens of millions of users. I think it really is affecting the way we relate to each other. And I, you know, again, commodifying friends and counting them up and putting them the sum of your friends at the top of your website, I don't think that that's any kind of healthy way to relate to people. As far as the caller's experience of reading many different kinds of newspapers at a cafe, he sounds like an exceptional person, and I'm certainly all for that. You know, reading newspapers, that's part of my life, and if he's reading them from Israel and Saudi Arabia, more power to him.
Is meaningful human interaction impossible online?
No. In fact, I think, as I write in my book, if it were not for email, I probably would not have been able to court my wife with any degree of success, because I'm fairly shy, and I would not have advanced myself professionally. I think email is one of the great wonders, and I think there are many avenues for meaningful human interaction on the internet. And as the internet grows out of its infancy, as you well put it, I think those avenues will increase. But we really have to be vigilant about all the junk. To quote Eric Schmidt again, about all the sewer organisms that are threatening these meaningful paths to each other.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Gloria in Fort Worth. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. You know, I've got so many things to comment on here, but I think Drew said it best, is he's reading all these different newspapers. Well, I find it hard to believe that he's reading those newspapers in hard copy. He's reading them online. And so, therefore, our social networking, if you will, are the haves and the have-nots. The people who are getting the information on the Internet are the bright people, the ones that can go in and pay $4 for coffee. But, you know, inner-city children who don't have access to it are losing a wealth of information. And as a semi-retired college professor in mass communication, I know what students are looking at. They're looking at my Facebook, and they're not looking at newspapers for information that might be worthy and useful to them in the long run. They're looking for instant gratification. So your comment on that.
Well, I think you're right. I do think that the instant gratification aspect is very crippling and very obstructive, especially to students. I also teach a course somewhere, and I lecture to about 100 students, and a lot of them are on their Facebook, you know, while I'm talking. And I think it's they do. I know they do that in other classes as well, though I might be particularly boring myself. But I think that that's standing in the way of them getting an education. As far as this business of information, we really live in a kind of cult of information. And I think information, as I say in my book, is useless when it's not converted into knowledge. We all have so much information. But if I could read 10 papers a day and not come away with one bit of that information that's useful to me in my life, but I could read 10 pages of a short story by Chekhov that will help me for the rest of my life. And the difference is that knowledge, which you get in philosophy or literature, it explores the deeper relationships between things. It gives context. It shows historical connections. Information is just little bits of data that are exchangeable on the marketplace. And unless you convert that into knowledge, I think information is more distracting and disempowering than anything else.
So do you think instant gratification of our desire for information is ultimately more destructive than instant gratification of our desire for material things?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Yes, I think that we're under the delusion when we go online that all this information is empowering us when it really is just numbing us and making it very difficult for us to sift through it, to choose things, to make decisions, to do the right thing again, to keep reverting to this, to the crisis now going on in this country. All the information in the world did not avert it. What's interesting to me is that this crisis grew and expanded parallel to the Internet. For the past 15 years, the Internet was growing, evolving, becoming strong. Well, so was this crisis. And all the information in the world didn't save us, and all the information we're getting about it, streams and streams of it every day, is not clarifying anything, not making anything better for anyone. So, you need people to come along, philosophers, scientists, poets, novelists, to refine information into knowledge, to turn knowledge into something that people can use, something that we can put into our consciousness as though it were keys to a home in our own pockets. Without that, then we're just suffering the illusion and the delusion of being empowered.
We have an email here from someone in Dallas who says, my major pet peeve is the obsession that everyone seems to have telling everybody everything second by second, blow by blow. I don't care that somebody is standing in line at Starbucks or that a friend's baby just burped. Do you have any perspective on why people feel the need to do this? I guess this is both Facebook and things like Twitter, where people do sort of give an account of everything that goes on.
Yes, well, Twitter is insane. I mean, William James once said that if at any one moment you could be aware of everything that's going around in the room, your head would explode. So you have all these people who basically want to make other people's heads explode. Twitter should be called Fritter because it doesn't lead to anything. It doesn't really tell you anything interesting. But I do think that, again, it's the result, and I talk about this in my book, of a culture, a commercial culture that stimulates all of our appetites, that makes all of us feel that we're at the center of the universe and that the most important and sacred experience we can have is gratifying our needs. And I think now this has entered into the realm of information, and information is instant gratification, as you put it, and Twitter is the latest development of that, and I think it's entirely debilitating, Twitter. I have no idea what it leads to, what it creates. You only have 144 characters to express yourself, so it's debasing language because everyone is sort of breaking language down into its basic units. And soon we'll be back in the Neolithic age when people spoke to each other in grunts. That's basically what Twitter is. You know, there's no difference between what you said to your friend in a cave and what you're saying to your friend on Twitter.
What's really interestingly is I think there are two ways to look at this. On the one hand, I think you're right. There's a certain narcissism and this idea that we're at the center of the universe. And then it also maybe on the opposite side of that is the sense that people must feel quite hollow if they need validation of every little thing they're doing and hope to get a Twitter back about something that someone has responded to what they're doing.
Yes, that's right. I think that, this culture became sort of psychologized a long time ago, the popularization of Freud and so forth. And all the things, the intimate experiences that we had, we suddenly saw on TV, in movies, in books, even in commercials. And so our inner life no longer seemed special to us. And so we gradually became hollowed out, and now we're just kind of creating activities with words to keep ourselves busy and perhaps expressing ourselves over and over again in order to find ourselves again. And it can be very exasperating when everyone's doing that all at once.
Let's go finally to Russell in Louisville. Hey, Russell.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was listening to the author's contention that the internet is just a bunch of noise and random bits of data. You know, the internet actually began as a research tool at CERN in Switzerland for scientists to interchange information. It's grown into a lot more, but it's an amplifier of the human psyche. It amplifies your best and your worst. You can take great ideas and broadcast them to the world and have them saved across eternity, or you can use it like a CB radio. You know?
Are there just a lot more bad ideas out there, Lee?
Well, there's certainly, because there are more people who are able to vent their ideas, there are more bad ideas. I think the CB radio is a good analogy. I don't know if any lasting bit of culture ever came from a CB radio. I don't know if anything that's broadcast on the internet will last for all eternity in the same way that something published in a book once did and still does to some extent. I just think that, I think, as I said, the internet really has given us a miracle of convenience, most of all. But when I think of my life 20 years ago, before the internet came along, I don't think of my life as any less fulfilling than it is now. And I don't feel that I had less access to information or to all the vital, essential things going on in the world. I think the internet's great. I think we could all live without it. I think we have to learn how to live with it. And so we better start criticizing it as well as boosting it.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you leave us with this idea that we need to distinguish between self-expression and actual communication.
Yes, and between self-expression and actual art. You know, as I say in my book, you would not look at a painting by Vermeer and say, well, that's a wonderful instance of self-expression, because what art really does, and great high art or popular art, what art does is sort of, it expresses you without addressing your life in particular. It expresses the universal through the particular. And when you have just a cacophony of self-expression, then you have no shared knowledge, and you certainly have no empathy going back and forth between people. So self-expression is really, really redundant, right? I mean, I'm expressing myself now. But if I were not talking to you, if I were just talking into a YouTube a microphone and broadcasting this across the internet, I would be expressing myself because I wouldn't really be talking to anyone in particular. But it would be redundant. I would simply be talking about myself, that's all.
I know in the last few seconds we have, you have a very young son. What are you going to tell him when he's old enough to go online?
That haunts me every day. I hope by then the internet will have become something humane and human, and I won't have to put up any kind of invisible fence around it.
Well, we can all hope that with you. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lee Siegel's new book is called Against the Machine: How the Web is Reshaping Culture and Commerce and Why It Matters. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.